interviews, Monday, April 11th, 2005. And we'll pretty well stick to our schedule committee today. However, it doesn't look like we'll have a work session on anything and that everything needs work. So it'll all be coming back to us. But we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3310. And House Bill 3310, Sam?
House Bill 3310, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, will pause the use of periodic reviews as a method for ensuring local government land use planning complies with statewide planning goals and statutory planning requirements. It has a number of provisions in there which would set up an interim committee which would look at annexation and consider making recommendations on that, and also some statutory changes that have to do with the economic policy. Modifies the land use board of appeal to require issues arising from periodic review considered by the Land Conservation Development Commission. It declares an emergency upon its passage.
Thank you, Sam. Committee members, you do have a report to the 2005 legislature on the Interim Committee on Periodic Review Reform. So this bill will probably be substantially amended. But to find out how substantial, I'd like to call forth a panel of John Van Landingham of LCDC, Roy Halliburton, and Lane Cheddarley. Gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome. John, it's good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I am from Eugene. I'm a constituent of Representative Ackermans. I am also the chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission, a very low-key group. Hopefully today we're here to talk about something that's not controversial. We're here to talk about the interim committee that I also chaired. The 2003 legislature created this interim committee and gave it the task of evaluating periodic review. The committee included representatives from counties, cities, the governor's office, that was Jim Brown, home builders, special districts, Thousand Friends, and land use planners. And I believe in the audience are a couple of members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, Burton Least, and John Chandler. I chaired the group, as I said. You've been given our report, which we concluded about 2 months ago. Rob Halliburton from the DLCD staff staffed the committee. Lane attended when he was able to, which was pretty frequently. This bill, HB 3310, would implement the recommendations of the committee. We have met with Representative Gillard and reviewed the recommendations. The bill that you have in front of you does not do that. It's probably not worth reading. The Dash 1 amendments will implement the report, and I understand that those are not ready, so the bill's not ready for you to move it. Let me do a couple of brief things. First, do what I would call periodic review 101. You probably already know from all the work that you've been doing in the interim and this session that in 1973 the legislature passed SB 100. It did two huge things. It directed LCDC to adopt statewide goals, and then it required local governments, every city and every county, to adopt a comprehensive plan that addressed those goals. And those plans were reviewed for compliance by DLCD, the department, and LCDC. By about 1980, that had happened pretty much. And the advocates and the department, and that would include the private sector, suddenly realized that, wait a minute, we haven't thought about a way to update these plans. That's what periodic review does. Periodic review is a method to require local governments to update their plans to make sure they're still in compliance with the statewide goals, that they still have an adequate supply of land for residential, commercial, industrial uses, and to allow the state to review those updates. That's what periodic review does. There are problems that have developed in those 20 years with periodic review. The report describes those problems in Chapter 3. Primarily, they could be described as that the process is cumbersome and complicated.
It takes too long.
And it costs too much money, both for local governments and for the state, for the department and the commission. The 1999 legislature made some changes to periodic review, primarily reducing the number of cities that had to do it, and focusing periodic review on land for housing, economic development, and transportation issues, and public facility issues. It's our view, the committee's view, that those changes are, the benefits of those changes are still being felt. There is still a long list of cities and counties in Pilot review. So this body in 2003 imposed roughly a four-year moratorium on Pilot review and directed the committee, our committee, to figure out what to do at the end of that period. That's what this report does. It makes recommendations for changing Pilot review so that when it starts up again in 2007, we think it will look better for local governments, for citizens, and for the state. There are six recommendations for changes. I can review those if you want, but you don't have the bill language in front of you, so I would only do that if you wish.
Committee, what's your desire?
They were provided with a copy of the report, so.
And there are the thank you, Sam, for mentioning that. The recommendations are detailed in detail in the report. I should have also mentioned that there is a minority report. Three members of the committee would like, roughly speaking, to require every city and every county to do prior review.
Right?
Mr. Chair, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I don't have anything to add to Commissioner Van Landingham's testimony. I think we are waiting for the Dash 1 amendments, which should implement the recommendations of the report. They've been requested. They're in the process of being drafted. We hope that they will be ready for today, but they are not. And then we'll be glad to come back, and that might be a more productive time to actually review the recommendations as you see them embodied in the Dash 1 amendments. But assuming that we get out of the amendments what we expect in terms of drafting, I think it'll be a bill that we can feel very good about in terms of carrying forward the fundamental policy of periodic review, but doing it in such a way that it does not unduly burden local governments that it targets the use of periodic review to maintain comprehensive plans up to date and justify the investment in time, energy, and resources for those communities that will most benefit from the outcomes.
John, I'm sorry. Let's let the panel finish and then we'll ask Mr. Halliburton.
I'm Rob Halliburton, Community Services Division Manager, and I was just here to help answer questions.
Okay. Committee, any questions? Representative Greenwick.
Assuming this looks like the six recommendations, is it safe to say that DLCD will be supporting the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, yes, absolutely.
Any further questions? Wow. We'll see you in the Dash.
Yeah.
Lane, will you let me know when the Dash 1s are available?
As soon as we get them out.
And then we'll schedule the next hearing on this bill. John, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3310 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2616. Sam?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2616 will direct all the counties to establish one or more rural zone, which do not qualify for exclusive farm use, forest use, or mixed farm forest use. It will then direct the counties to be able to plan for land uses that would allow for land divisions within these newly established zones, and it would allow any development within these zones to not require any goal exceptions that may be necessary in exclusive farm use zones.
Dave Hendricott, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Dave Hendricott, Urbanities in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 2616, although it does need a little amendment work. This is a bill that was similar to a bill that this committee heard last session. The idea being that there are, as you've heard over and over in this committee, there are lands outside of urban growth boundaries that are zoned for exclusive farm use or forest use or some type of mixed farm forest zones that really aren't by anybody's stretch of the imagination farm or forest land, and therefore are miszoned. That's the problem that happens when you take essentially all of your land outside of urban growth boundaries and call it either farm or forest land. counties over the years, at least some counties, have created non-resource zones to recognize some of those areas. Klamath County, for example, has a non-resource zone, and Douglas County has one. Cook County has one, and those land, in some of the counties, the land is zoned, those lands are zoned for non-resource use, but that isn't the case with all of the counties. The idea behind House Bill 2616 is to require the counties to recognize those lands that don't fall within the definition of ag land under LCDC's Goal 3 or forest land under LCDC's Goal 4, and allow some type of non-resource, some type of alternative use in those zones consistent with the fact that they truly aren't farm or forest land. There are two ways to do that. It can be done either as a mapping exercise requirement that the local governments go out and remap those areas, do the work themselves, and then make that determination. That, I believe, would have a fiscal, or alternatively something that would require the local governments to amend their comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances, and then allow the property owner to come in on a case-by-case basis and say, my land falls outside LCDC's definition of ag and forest land, and therefore the ag or forest zoning on that property is wrong and it ought to be changed. We would support either one of those, but I have a feeling for purposes of getting a piece of legislation out of this building with this economic climate, that is probably a better idea if the latter is adopted, and so amendments would be prepared to say that the county shall add language to their comp plans and zoning ordinances to specify that these types of zones are available, and then it's up, the burden falls on the property owner to come in and demonstrate that his or her property is not ag land as defined in Goal 3 or forest land in Goal 4. The bill needs to be amended in much the same fashion that it was last session, where if I can get a note from someone, I'll get these amendments prepared, where we'll actually take the definition of agricultural land in Goal 3 and forest land in Goal 4 and say, okay, if your land falls outside of these particular definitions, it's not class 1-4 soils in the western or in the valley. It's not 1-6 soils in eastern Oregon. It's not necessary or needed for existing ag operations on adjacent parcels. All of the they're lengthy criteria. I'm not giving you all of them, but if it falls outside of all of these various criteria, in other words, under LCDC's definition, it wouldn't be ag or forest land using their definition. Then under that, in that circumstance, you can go in and ask the county to allow you to make some alternative uses. We'll also add language that makes sure that the applicant still has to comply with the other 19 statewide land use goals other than goals 3 and 4. And bring that back for your consideration. So with that, the bill is nothing more than a recognition that there are lands out there that even under LCDC's definition of ag and forest land aren't ag and forest land, and to call those parcels agricultural land or forest land is an application of miszoning that the state has an interest, the state would have an interest in trying to fix.
Any questions, Representative Winnick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Dave. Afternoon, Dave.
Good morning.
Afternoon. I was explaining that to somebody. I understand the sense of the bill as it's written, 2616, and that you look at big areas and you say, well, here's 5,000 acres that really don't fit into that definition, and requiring a county, even a county that's very fertile, to say, okay, we'll set aside one or more of these. But what I've heard you testifying about, and I guess we'll have to wait till we see the words, my assumption is I could come in with a quarter of an acre and say, I've got this quarter of an acre in the middle of my 160 that's not ag use, and I want that rezoned non-ag so I can build a McDonald's on it or something. I mean, is that what you're talking about?
And Chair, what I represent Green Lake now, we can adopt some type of language that makes it, and I'd be more than happy to have a conversation with you about this outside of the committee. We can adopt some type of amendment that specifies that the predominant test, for example, so that you have to demonstrate that more than 50.1% of the property falls outside the LCDC's definition of agricultural land, or something of that nature. Or if you, that's something that I'd be more than happy to talk to you about, because that isn't what our intention with this bill is. The alternative way to do that would be to have the counties go ahead and do the planning exercise and do the mapping themselves. The difficulty with that is that it creates fiscal impact. So if, as long as the applicant is going to be the one driving the process, then what differentiates this bill from last session is what we're proposing is that the applicant drive the process. If the applicant's driving the process, then I'd agree with you that we need to make some specifications as to when the applicant can actually go in and demonstrate non-resource zoning on their property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
David, if you could you give me an illustration of what one of the one or more rural zones might be termed? Would it be marginal land, or would it be?
Chair Burrard, Representative Anderson, that I suppose would depend on the county. Each county has different names, not only for their, in the counties that have non-resource zones for those areas, but also for their farm and forest zones. There's no statutory requirement that they call these areas specific things. What would fit would be the non-resource zone designation, and that's if I was county council, that's certainly what I'd recommend to the board, that they just call these non-resource zones.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Dave. Will you let me know when you're ready with the amendments?
Absolutely.
And we'll reschedule the bill. Director Chevrolet, did you have a comment on? You didn't sign up for any comments, but obviously, we'd be interested if you do have an opinion on this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the work of the Wayne Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. We have had some high-level conversation with Dave on this, and we'll wait to testify until we see the amendments. But I would like to say on the record that we don't believe that misses-owned property advances the land use system. So to the extent that we can work with Dave to better identify what he's after in this bill, I think we have a chance of at least being neutral on the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Marge Easley.
Chair Garrard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marge Easley, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I actually am here to testify on behalf of both 2619 and 2616. And I have combined testimony, and I was wondering if that would be okay if I could say it all at once.
Certainly. Although we're not hearing. Oh, yes, we are. Sure. Okay. What I'd have to do is open a public hearing on 2619 as well.
Okay. Well, then maybe I could just confine my remarks to 2616.
Will you be around?
I can stay.
Okay, good.
Okay. As you know, the League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government in order to build better communities statewide. The League has been involved in support for Oregon's statewide land use planning program since its inception. We are appreciative of the fact that HB 2616 exempts Goal 3 farmlands and Goal 4 forest lands from the allowed or required development opportunities proposed. The League, however, opposes this bill. We feel that it makes a mockery of the goal exception process. It actually provides exemption from 7 goals. Goal 11, public facilities and services. Goal 14, urbanization. Goal 15, Willamette River Greenway. Goal 16, estuarine resources. Goal 17, coastal shorelands. And goal 18, beaches and dunes. And goal 19, ocean resources. And it would provide exemption from all 4 of the coastal goals. We feel that this bill would undermine the statewide nature of Oregon's land use planning program, as well as place an undue burden, actually a huge planning burden, on local government. And we thank you for allowing us to testify at this time.
Any questions of Ms. Easley? Sure. You must have done a good job. Thank you. Don Schellenberg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Schellenberg, representing Morgan Farm Bureau. I have to agree with Mr. Honeycutt regarding the reasons for this bill. And I think we've talked about this before. The biggest problem is the definition of agricultural land in Goal 3. But then added to that was the problem that counties didn't have the financial resources at the time to do the actual mapping that needed to be done in order to find out where these lands are that should be zoned to the FUU. And as Mr. Honeycutt said, they simply went out and outside the UGB, everything was either farm and forest or mixed farm forest. And so some land was swept into there that probably should not be in there. In spite of the economics that are present in the building here or out in the counties, we would have to say that we would support the county mapping concept rather than the individual person determining whether or not their property met the criteria. And of course the big issue or the big question there is, what is the criteria this land? What is the quote is, those lands that are not appropriate and qualified to be zoned for exclusive farm use? How do you make that determination? What I would offer is that we would certainly be happy to work with Mr. Honeycutt and anyone else, either in the legislative process here, or if it's done at the state agency level through LCDC, changing the definition, whatever it takes, we'd be happy to work on that process. Our concern would be that, you know, on a case-by-case basis, if we did it that way, we really end up not with a land use planning system. We end up perhaps, and Representative Greenwood maybe kind of touched on it, with a whole bunch of possibly non-farm uses being established all over in the EFU zone, which is not exactly conducive to agriculture production, depending on what the non-farm use is, of course. So I just want to offer our support for the concept and our help in trying to identify what these lands would be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Don, what agricultural products are produced on non-resource lands?
Well, Mr. Chairman, when I think about agricultural land, here in the valley, of course, we've got a lot of good land. And then we've got some land that's not so good. And as I mentioned before, even some of our not so good land is really good land for great production. And so it's a little hard to tell sometimes which is not good land. And then you get over your part of the country and over east as well. You have some good range land, and you have range land that's not so good. I mean, when you have a cow that has to pack a lunch or graze at 60 miles an hour in order to stay healthy, that's probably not so good land. And that's the kind of land I think that's envisioned here. But you have to find, you have to have a way of identifying and determining what that land is. And from our perspective, it needs to be, I mean, it would be best if it was in fairly large blocks. We want to keep our agricultural zones in fairly large blocks, too. So we'll just be happy to work on this with anybody that's going to be working on this. Trying to understand Mr. Hunkett has amendments, which I've not seen, but we'll be happy to work on those issues. Thank you.
I look forward to seeing those dash ones and coming back when we rehear the bill then, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir. Don, it would be my understanding that this is every county, so I'm assuming it's Washington County as well as other counties, that the folks in EFU now have a property tax system based on the farm productivity of it. If we took the areas of, say, Washington County, I don't know how big, but let's say a couple of areas of several thousand acres that we define as resource use, the property tax basis would change on that land, wouldn't it? Would your members be okay about that?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenwood, yes.
Yes, to
which? We would be okay. That's one of the probably one of the critical parts of the zoning activity. Farm use assessment is what you're talking about, and how the land is assessed based on its ability to produce. And if you have, for farm purposes, this land, all you can do with it is farm it, because you're in an EFU zone, that's fine. We accept that. But if you change it to another use, may not be farm use, and the value, the property tax value may change on that land because you now have other uses available. I mean, I'm certainly not sensing that when they identify these quote unquote non-resource zones, and I agree with Mr. Hunkett, I think that's the proper term that you would use, there would be other uses that would be allowed, non-farm uses that would be allowed, and there may be a greater market for that land in that for those uses. So yeah, I see the value changing, the property tax changing.
This would be a real boom to many farmers down in my neck of the woods, Don, because how much a piece of land can produce is directly proportionate to how much water you can get to it. So if the amount of water that you can get to the land changes, then it changes the value of the land immensely. So, Representative Anderson.
Just a comment first. Another question. I think I have a rhythm with a bunch of those cattle that you were talking about that are going 60 miles an hour. Is there a market for those somewhere?
It could be pretty skinny. Called slow elk.
And my question kind of relates a little bit to both Representative Greenlick and Garrard. There's a limit of $80,000 earned income for 160 acres. Is that correct? To be able to build a home on?
Mr. Chairman, no, that's not correct. In the farm zone, farm zones are split into two different categories, high-value farmland and other than high-value farmland. Okay, the kind of land you're talking about would be other than high-value farmland. And there's actually three different criteria that you can take advantage of in that category. One is an income test, and that's a $40,000 income test, gross income, not the $80,000. And in addition to that, it's either that or the median farm income for the county, and which in some counties is in the $20,000 range. So it just depends what county you're in as to whether it's $40,000 or whether it's less than $40,000. It's whichever is least. Then in addition to that, in some counties they've adopted also the capability test that measures within a 1 mile radius of where you want to put your dwelling, what the average size or the median size is of the parcels within 1 mile, and what's the median income of those parcels within 1 mile, grossing more than $10,000. And does your parcel have the capability to meet that median income, and is it of the median size or larger? So there's that kind of comparability test that's also available.
Thank you.
It's in that vein that 80,000 is off the planet in terms of most of the little ranches in western Jackson County or Josephine County. 40,000 might come close to median, maybe, and possibly just by capability, but there are very few farms or ranches that I know of in the area that I'm in that would meet that test, and that would tell me that there are a number of properties that would fit into this that should be not considered to be exclusive farm use. So,
thank you. Any further questions of Mr. Schillinger? Thank you, Don.
Thank you much.
Anyone else wish to comment on this bill? One?
Thank you, Chair Barrett, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan from 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm passing out testimony from Karen McLaren, who's our staff attorney, expert on farm and forest land. I just want to take a minute to go over some reasons we're opposing the bill. First, to draw your attention, the bill would open up over 900,000 acres now zoned for rural uses, which would be open to unlimited development. So it's quite broad in its scope. And the other, as Lou Women Voters articulated, it would provide development within these rural zones is authorized without exception to seven key statewide planning goals. And two of those goals three and four, are guided towards protecting our shared assets of the state. One most important being farmland, and certainly that's a resource that is finite and one we want to protect as much as possible. I'll attempt to answer any questions and be happy to get back to you if any questions you have something for the bill if I can answer them.
Any questions?
Just a housekeeping question. Who wrote this? I can't read his.
Oh, I didn't have the name, I apologize. It's Carrie McLaren. Carrie McLaren, M-A capital C L-A-R-E-N.
Okay.
Have you ever been to Carmel County?
No, but I'm going on Friday.
You ought to go down sometime and
absolutely
and see what this bill is all about.
I appreciate that.
Sure.
Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, I just have a question. Do you view the goals exception process as essential to this bill?
The goals exception process?
Isn't the goal to create a new classification of land? It seems to me you can do that without waiving the exception process as stated and started in line 13.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. I don't have to go in front of me and look at my testimony here, and I'd have to get back to you and better answer that. I'm not really sure. So
okay.
I'll talk to Kerry about that.
Thank you.
Representative Greenman?
I just wanted to comment, Mr. Chair. I did spend some time this weekend in faraway places like Heppner. And others, but this bill is every county in the state. So I mean, it's in the valley as well. And I'm far less nervous about what happens out there between Heppner and Pendleton, where I can see a lot of things happening differently than I am in Washington County and other counties. And perhaps we ought to think of this as the possibility of amending it to deal with. Again, as that other bill outside of Willamette Valley would make me feel a lot less nervous about it.
You might take that up in your conversation with Mr. Honeycutt. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
Anyone else who wishes to testify? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2616, and in that Representative Kitts is present, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3351. Mr. Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'll be all right. I'd like the Honeycutt to come up with me so I know what I'm talking about.
Now, the committee recognizes Mr. Honeycutt. Sam, you want to read the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Bill 3351 is one that's going to authorize the counties to approve an application essentially to in rural residential lands to be able to have partitions or subdivisions with the minimum lot size 2 acres or more, defines where the rural areas are, the lands that are not within the urban growth boundaries, the currently planted zone to allow for rural residential development, not comprised of any resource land and adjacent to an urban growth boundary. The issue is in a number of counties, 2 acres is apparently a minimum that is consistent with state guidelines. Some counties have the discretion to go greater than that, and that can be 5, 10, or virtually, I think, almost any number greater than 2 anyway.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having this hearing on this bill here today. I greatly appreciate it, as do my constituents who originally brought forward this bill. They brought it forward through the organization known as Urban Indians in Action, so I appreciate Dave Honeycutt's organization dropping this bill on behalf of my constituents who you will hear from, I think, following our testimony here today. Representative Greenlick, and thank you so much for going to Heppner this weekend and seeing firsthand what those people are doing with over there. It's great to have you. Colleagues, I think Sam's done a great job of explaining the genesis of the bill, or exactly what the bill would be. I'll explain the genesis of the bill. Most of you are familiar with, looking on the committee, all of you are familiar with the bill that we carried last session, the North Plains Bill. And in the North Plains Bill, this is the genesis of this bill, which basically has said that if you bypass exception land for the purposes of expanding an urban growth boundary and go on to EFU land, that the exception land that was in fact bypassed may in fact reduce their number of developable acres to from an AF5 zoning or an AF20 zoning to a minimum of an AF2, which is germane to state guidelines, as Sam has already talked about. So essentially, this is the other side of the North Plains Bill. Both constituents of mine thought it was a good bill, and taking on the other side of the fight this session. So playing both sides, I guess is fair to say. With that, I'll let Mr. Honeycutt say anything that he might have to say when fielding the questions that the committee may have at this time.
Any questions? Excuse me. Any questions of Representative Kitts? Seeing none, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt, Urban Indians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 3351. I was asked by Representative Kitts' constituent, Bob Josie, to draft a bill to deal with the other side of the North Plains issue. Now, this, fortunately, at least from my conversations to date, this doesn't have the controversy of last session's North Plains bill, and I'm certainly hoping to trying to keep it that way. The idea behind this bill, there's a priority statute in state law. It's 197-298. It's what this bill amends. The priority statute defines classes of land that should be included within the urban growth boundary. When a local government wants to expand its urban growth boundary, it goes through this list of priorities, and you'll see those on lines. The existing statute is subsection 1, and you'll see it there. We've renumbered it under this bill, subsection 2. It starts on line 20 of the first page of the bill and then goes on through line 3 of the second page of the bill. Essentially, the first priority is land that's already within an urban reserve study area. The second priority would be your exception lands, your rural residential type areas, maybe some rural commercial or rural industrial if those are around. Your third priority would be marginal lands as designated in either, I believe, Washington or Lane counties. And your fourth priority would be farm and forest land. So you got to exhaust the first three priorities to do your UGB expansion. And if you have you have enough land under, for example, your first priority, then you don't ever get to the second or third or fourth priority lands. If you run out of your first three priorities, then you get into farm and forest land. What this bill does is, and the particulars of the situation can be explained by Mr. Josie and Mr. Durr, what this bill proposes to do is say that if a local government has taken in land of one of the lower priority priorities, essentially, in this case, the fourth priority, if they've taken in farm and forest land and bypassed exception areas, land zone for some type of rural residential, rural commercial, or rural industrial use, then there's a recognition that those lands that have been bypassed aren't ever coming into the urban growth boundary, and so there's no reason at that point to allow, to not allow the property owner in the rural residential area to go ahead and develop that land down to what's still considered to be a rural use, which under LCDC's rules would be a 2-acre minimum parcel size. And again, the particulars of this case can be explained by counsel and Mr. Josie. But it's a recognition, essentially, that in an exception area, land that's not zoned for farm and forest use, if that land is not going to be bought into the urban growth boundary, and if land of lower priority, in other words, farm or forest land, is being brought into the urban growth boundary, the property owner whose land is in an exception area should be allowed to develop that down to the maximum extent possible while still remaining rural.
Any questions? Mr. Honeycutt.
Yes,
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Dave. I'm trying to understand this. Can I ask first, the main question, is this definition D, rural residential area, in line 9 through 17, is this a new definition, or is this the same definition you find for this term? Is this term defined otherwise in the statutes?
Gerard, Representative Greenlee, and again, Mr. Josie's counsel can also address this, but I believe that this is the definition that you find within LCDC's administrative rules when they define rural residential areas. I don't believe, Representative Greenlee, that there is, and I may be wrong, but I don't believe that there is a statutory definition for a rural residential area.
May I follow? You have any sense, and you may not have any sense, but the LC might, whether this changes by adding a definition, I'm going to say idiosyncratic, a new specific definition into the statutes, whether this changes the effect of other statutes, whether the term rural residential area is used in other.
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlee, the answer to that one is no, because the bill specifically provides in line 5 on page 1 as used in this section. So the language is specifically applicable only to this particular section and not other sections.
Thank you, sir.
Any further questions of Representative Kitts or Mr. Honeycutt? Seeing none, thank you, General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Will Bob and April Josie and Larry Deere come on up. Maybe we will have one person left to testify after this. Bob, we'll have you start off, okay?
Chair Gerard, members of the committee, I'm Bob Josie, 31965 Northwest Beach Road, Hillsboro, Oregon. Excuse me, guess can't see. The land use action of LCDC in the city of North Plains has put us in an impossible situation. We have land that cannot be reasonably farmed, but we cannot put into urban uses either. House Bill 3351 provides a reasonable compromise and a way out of this situation. My wife and I are farmers and own approximately 300 acres in Washington County. Of this land, 93 acres is zoned AF5 and Rural Residential 5, and is considered exception lands. This exception lands is adjacent to North Plains and south of Highway 26. My father bought this land in 1972, and at that time it was zoned RS1, which allowed homes on 1-acre sites. This zoning was consistent with the partial development already there. There were 16 homes built on 1-acre parcels on the edge of this land. He bought it with a plan to develop the land into 1-acre home sites. Next to the property, there were already an additional 7 parcels on less than 5 acres and one 6-acre parcel that had two homes on it. In 1976, Washington County rezoned all the land in the county, and because of these 25 homes on small parcels, this land was rezoned to the AF5 and Rural Residential 5, taking away the ability to build on the 1-acre parcels. Because of this new zoning, my father continued to farm this land and never developed it. My wife and I bought this property in 1983. Now there are 26 homes, non-farm dwelling homes surrounding our property on small parcels. Two-thirds of these homes are on 1-acre sites. Being good stewards of Oregon's valuable farm ground, we believe a 5-acre site is a large waste of land. So we have continued to farm this property. We decided to wait until North Plains expanded their urban growth boundary because historically exception lands have had the first priority in the city's UGB expansion. State laws, land use laws appear to protect farmland by directing the city's growth onto exception lands before allowing growth onto valuable farm ground. Zoned EFU. By definition, exception lands are not zoned EFU because these lands have some condition that makes them unfit for saving as valuable farmland. In our case, this is because our land was partially developed. North Plains has taken the stance that it cannot have a livable city on the exception land south of Highway 26 and therefore must expand onto valuable farmland. LCDC has agreed with North Plains. This position means North Plains does not intend to bring our land into the city now or in the future. Otherwise, the exception lands would have had the first priority. Washington County is in the process of approving North Plains expansion at this time. We do not know if we're the first in this situation, but we are sure we're not going to be the last. During the last 30 years of Oregon land use law, most cities have followed the law and used adjacent exception lands for their UGB expansion. Some of the remaining adjacent lands may not fit for a city's future UGB expansion. It is obvious by watching the North Plains expansion process and agreements by LCDCs to their wants that the rules protecting valuable farmlands are changing. Currently, LCDC is planning to make changes to Bill 14 that will make it easier for the cities to use the livability argument to bypass exception lands in favor of lower priority lands. To summarize our situation and why this bill is good for Oregon, the land use system, we have property that is not suited for long-term commercial farming and is zoned exception lands. This is because it is surrounded by non-farm dwellings and is adjacent to North Plains. In fact, because of its present zoning, it is not covered under Oregon's so-called right to farm law. The city of North Plains claiming that it never had a livable city on the exception land south of the highway. The state and the county agree with North Plains. And Washington County's smallest rural residential zone is 5 acres. We believe this was done to retain the area's rural character and preserve these parcels for future high-density urbanization. A smaller zone, such as 2 acres, would have retained the area's rural character, but it would not be easy to change to high-density urbanization. Allowing parcels of 2 acres is much better use of the exception lands than the present 5-acre zoning, again, unless the land is being saved for future urbanization. In our case, our exception lands will never be developed into high-density housing because otherwise it would have had first priority with North Plains UGB expansion. Therefore, a 2-acre zone would be the best way to maximize efficiency of land use for our land and other exception lands that will fall under this law. And there is a map of our land and the zoning code attached. And then Larry Durer, our counsel.
We thought we'd seen the last of North Plains. Mr. Durer, and I'll have your testimony and then we'll open it up for questions from the panel.
Thank you, Chair Gerard and members of the committee. Yes, my name is Larry Durer. Worked with the Joseph's for a number of years on various issues involving their property and had a hand in some of the drafting on this bill. And I'm pleased to represent to you, to my knowledge, the city of North Plains does not have a fight in this battle. It doesn't see a problem with this bill, although we asked them if they might support it, and they deferred on that as well. But Actually, this bill does not create any damage to what the city is doing, nor to what LCDC is in the process of doing. It simply tries to provide a compromise to address this specific situation. And the situation is one created. Dave Honeycutt talked to you about the priorities in ORS 197-298. Actually, that priority in a more general sense is in Goal 14 itself. And, of course, what it says is that when you have exception lands adjacent to a city, those ought to be looked at before you take in resource land. On the other hand, because maybe of a unique situation, maybe not so unique, that North Plains presented to LCDC, LCDC has expressed a willingness to step aside from those rules in some situations. And that led to the situation here where exception land adjacent to the city was not brought in and farmland was brought in. The compromise that this bill would provide is simply to allow development down to that 2-acre level, which is considered to be the minimum and still be rural land. It doesn't require urban services. Representative Greenlick asked the question about the rural residential language. That language is taken directly from LCDC's administrative rule on rural residential lands. The concern was that simply doing a cross-reference in a statute to an administrative rule is not a good form of drafting because the legislature doesn't control the context of the rules. So we took that language, and Legislative Council agreed with that approach and adopted it into this one section. But the effect of that is that if the legislature adopts this bill, then it has in effect on that LCDC administrative rule to the extent, only to the extent, of allowing the minimum 2-acre size, which the LCDC rule could be read in some circumstances not to allow. Just quickly, the concept, of course, is that if you have exception land that's surrounded by farmland, that's not a good place to urbanize. But on the other hand, if you have exception land that is adjacent to a city, and you also have rural residential, or excuse me, you also have resource land, farmland next to the city, then you would think that that is where you ought to go. Over the years, cities have presented a number of fairly innovative arguments to LUBA and the courts about why they ought not to have to follow that rule. And until recently, without exception, each of those arguments has been rejected. The LUBA and the courts have said, no, Goal 14 means what it says, and now 197-298, and you have to follow the priority. But with the North Plains situation, LCDC said, well, maybe we need to modify that a little bit. And in fact, LCDC is now poised, I believe it's coming up on their agenda on the 28th of this month, to amend Goal 14, in part to codify the positions that they took in that North Plains situation. That's fine. We're not arguing with that. But what we're saying is that opens the door to some fairly generalized situations and let your imagination run the course as to what else might fit that situation. Fine to do that. But when you have landowners like the Joseys that are caught in the middle, where they and their families bought property adjacent to cities with the reasonable expectation that eventually it would urbanize, and now they're told that, no, it just doesn't work for this particular city, then they need this safety valve. You may also note in the bill that it excludes from its application the metro urban growth boundary. In talking to some of the people at Metro, we realized that in that specialized situation where the Metro urban growth boundary is so large, it has such a huge and diverse perimeter, that we could, if we included that within this bill, have been drawing in some situations that were not appropriate. Specifically, there could be some areas that in one expansion were passed over, but are still on the list as places for possible future expansion.
what this bill attempts to do is only hit those areas where there has been a focused look at the exception land and where the cities have said, no, this doesn't work for us, we're not going to go there, and provide some kind of an effective use for that land. The last thing that I want to mention before opening to questions is it's important to note that the way the bill is drafted, it is intended to be self-executing. By that I mean that it would not require and does not require any amendment by a county of the lot sizes in its zoning or any change in LCDC goals or rules. The two-acre allowance would be available by reason of the legislation. Obviously, still requiring a property owner to meet all other applicable requirements of the law. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Durr?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand from what you're telling us that you're interested in a particular piece of property or a particular situation, but the language seems to be drafted to be more general. Do you know how much land would be affected by this bill or have its status changed by this bill?
Chair Gerard, Representative Nolan, I can take an attempt at answering that question. To my knowledge, there is no other land that would, as we sit here today, be affected, because to my knowledge, LCDC has not yet approved another urban growth boundary expansion under this scenario, namely where adjacent exception land was passed over in favor of adjacent resource forest land. However, with the changes that LCDC is proposing to make, they are clearly anticipating that there will be additional cases in the future.
Thanks.
Representative Ackerman.
Just a couple of questions. If I read the narrative, is it likely that with the zone change after the property was purchased that there's a Measure 37 claim here?
There is probably not, and of course that gets into the details of Measure 37. Mr. Josie's father bought the land at a time ahead of all of these rules. If he were alive and still owned the land, there would clearly be a Measure 37 claim. However, he is not, and the Joseys purchased the land from him prior to such rules as the 94 changes for the $80,000 limit and some of the other restrictions, and also prior to the change from the AF5 to the AF1 zoning. So, while you could go back to the day that the family first acquired the property and look at the diminution in value, what you would certainly encounter would be the county saying, but we will exercise the option under Measure 37 to waive only those rules that were in effect when Bob and April acquired the property, and those are essentially today's rules.
Just one additional question. Now, what's zoning now? Is it for any residential uses at all?
I'll answer that. Representative Gerard, Representative Ackerman, it's AF5, Agriculture 5, which means you can build a house on 5 acres, and it's Rural Residential 5, which means you can build a house on 5 acres.
Thank you.
Those are two separate zones.
Yes, I understand. Mm-hmm. Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, sir. I do have a little familiarity with the North Plains situation. I'm trying to read the bill, the existing statute, and I don't see anywhere in the existing statute that says having passed up the use of exception land in one urban growth boundary, that automatically means it won't be included in the next urban growth boundary. Is there, but somewhere in the testimony I sense that's what's being said here. I mean, there was a reasonable expectation that it would be taken into the urban growth boundary sometime in the future. That expectation no longer exists. Is that, am I?
Yes. Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlick. In this situation, the city has made it very clear
and LCDC has endorsed that reasoning in its approval of the city's action, that the exception land was not taken in because it does not meet the needs of the city. Now, certainly, in theory, it's possible that 10, 15, 20, 50 years from now, another city council or another population in North Plains might decide that there needs a change. I never want to say never, but the fact is that all representations are that the city has no intention of going this direction, and we think it's a totally reasonable position to take, that you don't leave this land on the shelf for an indefinite period of time for future urbanization, and maybe for never when you have those circumstances.
Thank you. Any further questions? Say none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Bob Reddy. Committee was the last person who signed up to testify on this bill.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. You'll have to bear with my cold today if you want to get through this testimony. Director Shetterly did have to leave for a meeting that he had previously arranged. And in listening to the testimony, I think it's fair to say that we didn't grasp all of the reasons and intentions of this bill when we analyzed it last Friday. And as such, I'm not going to turn in written testimony. I do want to indicate there are a couple of situations here that you might want to think about with this bill. Yes, currently there is an LCDC rule regarding rural minimum lot sizes. It's my understanding now, listening to the testimony, that this is limited to a very narrow situation where a city has amended an urban growth boundary and in the process has passed over some exception land. And I presume it could mean any piece of land, or maybe it only applies to the exception land that a certain person owns and applies for. I want to point out that it's often the case that a city will expand an urban growth boundary for one reason only, and a good one is industrial land. We recently had the case of Metro expanding the urban growth boundary only to provide for large industrial sites, and as such, large flat industrial sites don't typically occur on rural residential areas, and as such, the city probably didn't look at any of the exceptions land. There are other cities that are contemplating the same thing or in the process of doing the same thing. I know you will be seeing a bill before you that we've been working on with Tom Gallagher that will be talking about just that situation where cities are expanding the boundary just for a certain kind of need. And I don't see that really mentioned in here. In other words, there may be many cities throughout the state that have exceptions land adjacent to the city, and it might be in large lot zoning precisely because the city and the county are hoping that as that is brought into the boundary, it can be efficiently urbanized, which wouldn't happen if you cut it into smaller pieces such as 2-acre lots. But they might today be wanting to expand the boundary for industrial purposes. It's not that they're not going to expand the boundary even next year to take in needed residential land. It's just that at the current time, I know a lot of cities are interested in trying to acquire shovel-ready sites, and they're likely going to bypass all the exceptions land. I will mention that there are some other rules and some zoning in place in other areas besides Metro where areas that are adjacent to the boundary are specifically held in larger lots, maybe 10 or 20 acres, precisely because they are contemplated for being brought into the city in the future. I can't tell today, just hearing the testimony, whether those areas are excluded from this bill. It might not be the case. For that reason, I'd like to amend our testimony that had been written earlier, work that through with Lane Chetterly and bring that to you.
Sure. Sounds good, Bob. Any questions of Mr. Rindy? Representative Ackerman.
I'm a little bit puzzled about some of the consequences of this bill. Do you view this bill as a mandate to extending urban growth boundary to include the rural residential area contemplated by the bill?
Okay.
regard to Representative Ackerman. I don't see it that way. I am a little bit concerned about the wording on page 2, line 16 and 17, as to whether that requires the county to approve 2 acres, even if they don't want to. I can see some people thinking it might mean that, and it's not clear, but I think I did hear Mr. Honeycutt indicate that the intent here is to allow the county and not require that, so I don't think that that's the intent.
This is one follow-up. Then if that's true, and this is not a mandate to include this land within the urban growth boundary, what value is the subdivision of 2 acres or more? I mean, it's not within the urban growth boundary. How do you extend services to this these lots?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I don't know the particular circumstances around those plains, but generally in that area, a 2 acre lot will perk for a septic tank, and if there's water available by well, the presumption is that's how it would be served.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Now, committee, we have one more person to speak. Art Slack, please.
Well, he's coming up. Are we going to act on this today?
I'd really like to ask the LC that wrote it to talk about it, because I'm trying to find out what it actually does, and I think it does something beyond what's being proposed. I mean, it seems to me all it does is define this rural residential, which can be anything in a adjacent to an urban growth boundary that's exception land, and then allow that anywhere, not regardless of whether there's been an urban growth boundary expansion or not, to be subdivided. And if that's the intent, that's fine, but I think it's really clear for us to understand what this does, and I don't think an expansion or non-expansion is urban growth boundary triggers this action. I think it then becomes automatic.
I think that's a valid question, Representative. Mr. Slack?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address the committee with regard to House Bill 3351. I just want to make two quick points. One is I think it's important that counties in this case have the ability to establish what they believe is a rural density and appropriate rural zones within their community at this point, based on services and a lot of other factors at this point. I do not believe at this point Washington County has a 2 acre zone. So by this action, the legislature may be telling Washington County to create a 2 acre zone. I think local authority and responsibility is appropriate, and the county should go through, any county should go through the exercise of establishing those zones without being necessarily directed to do that by the legislature, given the fact that we do have direction in terms of the administrative rules addressing the Curry County case, and we know that for those counties that do not have a 1 acre zone that has been acknowledged because of prior circumstances, the 2 acres is the minimum under Curry County that can be created at this point in time. Secondly, Mr. Chair, I think your committee is going to see and has seen some bills that are coming forward to address particular issues and circumstances. And I just call to your attention that there are discussions going on with respect to Measure 37 to deal not only, well, to basically deal with all lands outside urban growth boundaries. And I'll deal with those in the context of their potential rural development opportunities at this point, given Measure 37 and potential claims that have been filed, and how we look at, shall we say, conserving some of the better agricultural and forest land and allowing more development on rural lands at this point. And certainly lands that are already designated for rural development should have an opportunity or may have an opportunity in the future to have more development based on the overall approach. And so I would just hope that the committee takes into consideration that you have not looked at a comprehensive review or view of what might be looked at as an omnibus bill dealing with Measure 37 prior to making individual, shall we say, corrections or amendments to the land use system in the state as a whole or in any particular. With that, Mr. Chair, I would answer any questions.
See you again. Thank you, Art.
Thank you, sir.
Anyone else wish to testify? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3351. And committee, because we have a couple people that we were hoping we can get some quick testimony in on, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2619 and ask Marge Easley and Ross Day to come forward, please. Ross, do you have time to testify or not?
Can Mr. Lee come up with me as well?
Sure.
And, Mr. General, while they're approaching the stand, I'll tell you that in the committee, the House Bill 2619 is one which will authorize counties to designate a new zone. It was a rural development zone, which would not require any exceptions to statewide planning goals. To urbanization of public facilities is one which would allow commercial uses, industrial uses, and public uses to be in there. It will prohibit LCDC from adopting or implementing rules for development within these. It specifies where some locational factors for where these new zones would be. Essentially, they cannot be on qualifying EFU or forest lands, cannot be in urban reserve. Urban reserve are defined as some cities will have, all cities have urban growth boundaries. Some cities have gone beyond identified land in the future that they would grow into, and these are referred to as urban reserves lands, so this would also be offering for this consideration of this, and then it has some other locational factors for proximity to markets and products and et cetera. But that's a quick overview of what this bill does.
We're also that I know you have 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you go ahead and start off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, Ross Day, Director of Rural Affairs at Oregonians in Action. Appreciate the opportunity today to present testimony on House Bill 2619. You might recall this bill was House Bill 2689 from the last session. Bill that eventually made its way through the process, and I think Mr. Lieber will talk a little bit more about that. One of the things I want to emphasize about this bill that you need to understand, we're talking about land that's not farmland, that's not forest land, that can't be used in conjunction with farmland or forest land. I mean, we're basically talking about land that's not going to be put to resource use. We're not talking about primes or class ones or twos soils. We're talking about scab land is what we're really talking about. I mean, class A out in eastern Oregon. What this bill does is it allows counties, it doesn't require it either, it allows counties to go out and if they like to create rural development zones so that counties can take advantage of lands that otherwise doesn't produce any economic benefit for the local government. That's all the bill does, nothing more, nothing less. You're probably going to hear a lot of testimony about how it's going to destroy Oregon's land use system and gut Oregon's land use system and destroy thousands of acres of farmland. That's true, technically, I suppose, when you've got a system that only allowed counties one of two options, zone land outside of forest land, outside of urban growth boundaries, basically farmland or forest land. If it's class 8 soils, farmland, it's really not farmland at all. It's sand, basically, really. That's what it is. And so to the extent that may be accurate, technically, you'd say, in reality, practically speaking, what you're talking about is land that has absolutely or relatively no economic resource value whatsoever to the county. What this measure does is it allows the counties, allows the county, if they so choose, to go out and create these rural development zones. I think this is a smart bill, certainly, not just because we drafted it, but it because I think it makes good sense. I mean, if the land can't be put to any other use, why shouldn't local governments be allowed to put it to some use that's going to ultimately benefit the local community? So with that, I hope that you'd support the measure, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Can we take questions from Mr. Day right now, if there are any? Okay, thank you, Russ. Marge, do you want to go next?
Thank you. Representative Anderson, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marge Easley with the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I just have very brief comments because I testified earlier on 2616, but I feel that 2619 also nullifies the exception process, and what it actually does is superimpose a new goal and criteria for lands not zoned as resource lands, this goal being economic development in rural areas. It would, in effect, have prescriptive standards required of local government and would allow hotels, motels, community sewer and water systems, and commercial or industrial uses in buildings of any size or type. The League firmly opposes 2619. We feel it would undermine the statewide nature of Oregon's land use planning system. Keeping in mind that we do have a statewide planning system, and exceptions often tend not to look at the statewide nature of our system. We feel it would place a huge burden on local government as well as the previous bill that was talked about, 2616. Thank you.
Any questions? Ms. Easley, what would the burden on government be when it's private land?
It would put in place someone has to decide as to what land is categorized as, and it would be a burden to decide, okay, what exact criteria would make some land valuable, others not, and feel it would be a burden that would be on local government.
Would you consider a burden on the private landowner that they have land that can't be used for farming or forestry and now they can't use it for anything?
Right. We definitely feel that there is a need to do something in that case, but whether this is the right approach, we disagree with, because we feel it would be superimposing a new goal that would take precedent over other goals.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to testify in support of House Bill 2619. This bill is nearly identical to a bill that we introduced last session, House Bill 2689, which did pass the House of Representatives but ran into some trouble on the Senate side. Nonetheless, our friends at OIA brought this bill back this session, and we still do obviously support the concepts contained within it. I wanted the committee to focus for a second on the actual text of the bill. If you look at lines 4 and 5, this act is the Rural Planning and Economic Development Act. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about rural planning, and we're talking about economic development. Rural Oregon has really not experienced much of the economic recovery that much of the metro regions experienced during the 1990s, and the unemployment rates have maintained a very steady and very high rate during those years, and in many cases double-digit unemployment over much of rural Oregon. As the timber economies in much of these locations crashed, nothing was allowed to come back and replace those jobs simply because we have
a planning system that has not allowed for rural economic development. This bill would allow counties to do that. And again, this is a permissive bill. It doesn't require any government to do anything. It only allows counties to do this if that is what they decide they want to do. And what does it allow them to do? It allows them to actually plan on the rural exception lands for economic development. These are lands that have already received exceptions to goals 3 and 4, so we're not talking about any farmland. We're talking about exception lands. We're talking about non-resource lands, lands that have already been designated as not being for the purpose of agriculture or timber. So this land has already received that designation. The bill gets around some requirements that have been imposed on these lands by Goal 14 and Goal 11, which result from the Curry County decision, which was a decision the Supreme Court reached in the late 80s regarding what is a so-called urban use versus what is a rural use. This bill would return some authority to counties that wanted it, again, only counties that wanted to use this authority, to now once and for all plan these lands, these exception lands. We brought this bill forward based on a few examples of development projects that were either not allowed to go through or were only allowed to go through but with such modifications required by the state that they did not become viable. An example of that was the speedway that was approved in Morrow County outside of the city of Boardman. That was a situation where a NASCAR-style speedway was going to be sited on some exception lands out there, already zoned for industrial commercial uses, but the case was appealed because the DLCD did not like the provision contained in the application that involved a hotel. The problem is when the developers did their analysis of these speedways all over the country, they found that many of them had hotels, and the purpose for the hotel was so that when high rollers flew into town to watch the race, they could stay at a nice hotel. Unfortunately, the city of Boardman does not have very many five-star caliber hotels in its urban growth boundary, so the thinking was that they would, and if anyone's here from Boardman, I apologize, the thinking was that they would put it in this project. That was appealed, and ultimately at the LUBA level taken out of the decision so that the speedway was finally approved on remand, but the motel option was taken out, and now they're having trouble getting this project off the ground because the developers are not so keen on building something that they don't think people are going to come to. So there's one example. There are some other examples outside of the city of Florence along the Central Oregon coast. There were some industrial properties zoned for rural industrial use, and there was a gentleman that wanted to purchase these properties and rehabilitate the buildings and put in a facility there. He built something that you put on airplanes. I'm not sure of all the details, but it was something where he needed to have some lathes in a metal shop. And when he was notified that Lane County was downzoning these lands based on a DLCD requirement, they adopted building size limit, he just upped and left, and he built that facility and created those jobs in Northern California. So there's another example of opportunity lost in the state of Oregon, jobs and tax base that we do not have in the state. This bill was designed to deal with these issues. Areas that have already received exceptions, areas that have already been designated for industrial, commercial, or residential use, but are still subject to these Goal 14 and Goal 11 requirements. This bill was designed to get around that. Again, for only those counties that determined it was in their economic development interest to do so. So counties that decided they did not want to use this would not be required to. They could continue the status quo. It was only those areas that felt that they had economic development needs that could be justified based on the findings in this bill. Again, this is not a bill that allows for anything goes. The counties would be required to identify specific objectives and specific boundaries and a whole bunch of other requirements in their findings in order to justify this rural development zone. So this bill is about planning. This bill is about finally allowing these counties to actually plan for economic development and job growth in these areas. So again, I I lead you back to the name of the act, the Rural Planning and Economic Development Act of 2005. That's what this bill would do. We would ask that this committee support this bill and favorably move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Glenn Gross, Don Schellenberg, Bob Windy. Good afternoon. Glenn, you want to start off?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Glenn Gross, and I'm the Urban Planning Administrator for the City of Salem. The City of Salem opposes House Bill 2619 for major fiscal concerns. The city's concern that this bill, if passed, would siphon existing jobs away from the city. The city has and will continue to make major investments in infrastructure which need to be supported by economic development within the city and the urban growth boundary. This bill could lead to duplication of services such as a community water supply. I'll keep my comments brief, but be happy to try to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, we'll wait for the entire panel to speak, committee. Bob? Don? Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I have handed you some written remarks. Mr. Shetterly apologizes he couldn't be here to present these. This is, by our count, the fourth bill this session, and I think two of them you have already heard that are pretty much on the same subject, and that is the subject of allowing more expansive, larger commercial and industrial uses in rural areas. And we didn't repeat all of our remarks, but I did want to note a couple of things. First of all, it's our interpretation, and I did hear the previous panel, so maybe we've misinterpreted something here, but it looked to us like this bill was intended to apply to all the exceptions lands, or non-resource lands, or arguably marginal lands, in the state. If that's correct, that's around 1 million acres statewide right now that are zoned in some manner or another for other than farm or forest use. Generally, the urban growth boundaries throughout the state, as you just heard, have been something that were put together over the last 30 years as part of the planning program to provide 20 years supply of land for commercial industrial use and other economic and development opportunities, to provide lands that are serviced, have sewer and water, roads and other things that they need. So we did want to note that this will be a change, a major change to Oregon's land use program that will likely create the conflict in that we have spent an awful lot of time trying to provide lands for these areas, and our product review process is geared towards continuing to expand that supply in urban growth boundaries, but this will allow those uses outside. Likely, one of the most likely effects, if counties end up choosing to designate large areas for pretty much anything goes, I think is under the standards of this bill, that there will be additional pressures for sewer and water systems to serve those, and for road improvements that may not be currently planned. We have noted previously that we understand that this is a highly controversial area, and it certainly has been something that's received a lot of attention by LCDC, and LCDC has commissioned a work group that has been meeting, and we intend, I hope very soon, to also propose some amendments to LCDC rules, not that that would or should slow you down, but just wanted you to know that we're also working on this problem. We probably might likely come up with, we're hoping to come up with a solution that has a broad consensus. That's part of why we've commissioned that work group. With that, I'll close and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schoenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. We agree that there's a need for additional economic opportunities in rural areas. We also believe that these opportunities, if done judiciously, can be provided without a negative impact on the existing agricultural industry. Just like to take a moment to remind you of the importance of agricultural industry in Oregon. Oregon agriculture has over 20 years of continuous growth in farm gate value of production. As a single traded sector industry, agriculture produces 12% of the state's gross product and exports 80% of everything we produce. In addition to that, Oregon provides a great agriculture provides a great stability to both the economy and the communities of Oregon. Section 5, subsections 3 through 8 identify the uses that would be allowed in rural development zones. Taken together, the uses such as residential, commercial, industrial, public, hotel, and motel, and community sewer and water systems sound an awful lot like a city. I don't know if that is the intent of the bill, but even if it is, there may be locations where those are appropriate. At the same time, there are places where such activities are not needed. We would suggest an amendment that would emphasize the establishment of such zones outside the Willamette Valley, but not necessarily prohibit them in the valley. This could be done by adding to the end of line 23, page 1, the phrase, quote, that are greater than 15 miles from a city with a population of 5,000 or more, end quote. This would tend to focus and give the greatest leeway to rural areas outside the valley while assuring that the development zones are in fact rural. At the same time, the zone would be close enough for easy commuting from existing rural towns, but far enough away to not compete with the existing cities, as was mentioned by the city of Salem here. According to the 2003 Oregon Blue Book, only 69 of Oregon's 198 cities have a population of more than 5,000, and only 30 of those are outside the Willamette Valley. That leaves a lot of open space for appropriate rural economic development zones. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to comment today.
Any questions of the panel? Don, I'd just like to comment. Recent weeks, the Farm Bureau has come before this committee on numerous occasions that you're neutral on the bill, but you're suggesting ways to make the bill more palatable, and I'd like to compliment the Farm Bureau on that somewhat change in direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further questions, Linda Ludwig and Gulan Hassan. Committee, these are the final two testimony we'll take on this bill. You also have been handed a letter from the Economic and Community Development Department, which I find astounding because they're against an economic development bill. Linda?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig for the Permanent League of Oregon Cities. I think you've heard from several of the previous testifiers some of our issues, and you've heard them in committee before. Cities' concerns here would be the designation, encouraging counties to designate these high-intensity commercial, industrial, and potentially residential uses outside UGBs, and the provision of infrastructure, including water, sewer facilities, and transportation, and the effects that that would have to cities and communities inside UGBs. This is, again, a different way of doing business than we've seen in the past, and a different direction than the planning program has given to cities in terms of urbanizing. And we think that it is significant enough to really take some careful steps and make an evaluation of if that's where we indeed want to go. We have seen several other bills deal with this issue, but this bill would be inclusive of the Willamette Valley, which the prior bills this committee has seen would not be. And it has some broader impacts than those bills do. Additionally, as we've been moving forward in the Measure 37 issue and discussing some changes resulting there, It may be wise to entertain this broad spectrum concept with regard to the Measure 37 discussions. I think there is some ideas of merit here, the focus on economic development and certainly the rural focus, but again, across the board, cities have some concerns if we don't narrow the focus of this language in the existing bill.
Thank you, Elon Hassan, 1000 Friends of Oregon, Chair Guard, members of the committee. 1000 Friends of Oregon also opposes this for a lot of the reasons that have been articulated earlier. I think the main ones being that it seems to devalue the productivity of urban growth boundaries. One comment earlier was, what is the cost that one would be concerned about this? And it's the public and private investment that has been made inside cities to allow for this kind of development. These are now compete with cheaper lands outside of UGBs, which can be a net loss for the state. And that is one of our concerns. I'd also like to correct my testimony from last time, Representative Anderson. I misspelled my colleague's name. McLaren is M-A-C capital L-A-R-E-N.
Any questions? I don't even need to look to my right anymore. Seeing none, thank you both. Anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 2619? Seeing none, I'm wondering if Harland and Don Schellenberg and Ross Day, if you three can get together on this bill and take a look at maybe making it more palatable. If you can do that, we'll bring it back and hear some more on it. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2619 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3315.
House Bill 3313. Is a bill which will clarify the process that's used in determining density for dwellings in the area of forest land, and for to be able to site a home on a property that has a forest designation. One alternative method involves a template test, and the template test is one which where there's a 160-acre square or a 160-acre rectangle that's located on top of the property, and then the number of properties, parcels that are within that template are counted, and the number of dwellings also within that template are then also counted. Minimum should be 3. Some counties can have a little bit more than that at their discretion, but that essentially is a template test. It's an alternative method to be able for locating a dwelling in farm zones. And this particular measure would would amend that process so that any, as it's centered on the property, any dwelling that's has to be, that is, some counties, I think Multnomah County is one that comes to mind, that the dwelling has to be, when you're counting those, has to be entirely within that 160 template area. The question then can come up, what happens when a portion of a dwelling is within that area, or a portion of it just touches the bottom, the margin, the boundary line, or the area straddles the area. And measure aims to deal with that. You can have houses that just straddle the line, don't have to, you can count those. Some counties don't count those. They have to say it has to 100% be in there. I'm aware that there is has been discussion that this section needs to be modified. Maybe an amendment coming on this one.
Okay. Dave Honeycutt? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify in this bill besides Mr. Honeycutt? Yes, sir. Did you want to testify?
My name is Marvin Land. My name is Wilfred Harris, and I'm talking about things you can arrange for me and stuff like that.
I'm not aware of any arrangement. If you'd like to testify in this bill, you'd be welcome to. But
which that act is about what?
This is House Bill 3313.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Mr. Honeycutt, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 3313. Mr. Chair, will need some amendments, but the idea here, there is, in forest zones, not in farm zones, but in forest zones, there is a provision in law as a result of House Bill 3361 in the 93 session that's known as the forest template test. In order to qualify for a dwelling under the forest template test, you take either a 160-acre square or a 160-acre rectangle, and you place that, the center of that square, we'll just use the square, on the center of your parcel, and then you count the number of parcels that are wholly or partially within that 160-acre square. And if you meet a certain, if you have a certain number of parcels with a certain number of dwellings on those parcels, then the theory is that you're in a forested area that's impacted already by smaller size parcels with dwellings on it, and therefore you're entitled to a dwelling on your property under the forest template test. Now, under state law standards, you don't count state law doesn't require that the dwellings themselves have to be within the template. So I take a 160-acre square around my property, and I count maybe, let's say there are four parcels that are partially within that 160-acre square. The dwellings themselves don't have to be within the 160-acre square. They can be outside of the square as long as the parcel on which the dwelling sits, part of it is within the square. That's it's somewhat confusing, but if you do it enough, it makes sense. However, some counties, the statute itself doesn't prohibit counties from being more restrictive, and there are certain counties that have imposed more restrictive requirements. As Sam said, Multnomah County, for example, requires that the dwellings themselves also be within the 160-acre template rather than being outside. So what the genesis of 3313 was a lawsuit that came out of Multnomah County, where Multnomah County requires five dwellings, and under Multnomah County's test, the template line actually went through one of the dwellings. So there were four dwellings within the 160 acres, and on the fifth dwelling, the line right smack dab through the middle of a dwelling. Multnomah County's position was the entire dwelling had to be within the template, and because the entire dwelling wasn't, you know, maybe the garage and the bathroom were, but the bedroom and the kitchen weren't, that the dwelling didn't count as part of the dwellings within the template, and therefore the property owner, a lady by the name of Kathleen Worman, couldn't qualify for a template dwelling under that test. Under state law, she would have qualified, and our argument to Lubo, which we lost, our argument to Lubo was within doesn't require that the entire dwelling be within. As long as part of it is within there, it should be okay. We lost that argument because this was a Multnomah County regulation as opposed to a state mandate, and Lubo deferred to the county and said the county's interpretation was reasonable. What we want to do when amending this is to amend this to say that as long as part of the dwelling is within the template, if it's on the line and part of it's within, the whole thing comes in. This is that case is maybe the only case in Oregon that is impacted by the amendments that we're proposing to make, and it may not be. But the point is, from our perspective, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you draw the square and you've got the garage and the living room but not the kitchen and the bathrooms to say that the entire thing is outside of the template. And so I don't think there's any opposition to this bill with those amendments. It would be an extremely narrow bill, but to the extent that there are other property owners, you know, around the state that would also be benefited from it, that'd be great. We've got some suggested language amendments that will make the as worded now, the existing bill goes beyond that. That needs to be changed.
So basically, this is a bill just Kathy Warman.
Kathleen Warman.
Well, she wanted to be here to testify, and we kind of got mixed up with our dates. But since you have to have an amendment, we can make sure that she comes in and testifies at that time.
And Mr. Chair, I'm certainly not saying that she's the only property owner. There are maybe others. I don't know of any. I've never heard of anybody who's in a county that has a requirement that the dwellings be within the template, and I don't know beyond Multnomah County which other counties, if there are any that have that, have had the situation where one of the dwellings sits right on the line of the 160 acres. There may be others, there may not, but this is the only one that I've ever heard of.
Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, clarify for me, if you have a template and there are five or, say, six dwellings to be within that, and you have five, but the sixth has no portion within it, how do you declare that sixth one is actually partially in?
Chair, Representative Anderson, if no portion of these, let's say there was a requirement that you have six homes within the template, and no portion of the sixth home was within the template, then it wouldn't count. You'd only have five, and you wouldn't get an approval.
But isn't that what I read here? Nothing in this section requires any portion, or is that what you're planning on amending?
Chair, Representative Anderson, this language needs some work.
Couldn't hear that, sorry.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bowen.
Mr. Hanukkah, can you just provide us with some kind of color code for when it is you want the counties to be able to make decisions on their own, and when it is you want the state to intervene and tell the counties what they're supposed to do? Because sometimes today you came forward and said, we want the counties to make their own decisions, and right now you're essentially coming forward and saying, no, the counties don't know enough to make their own decisions, and we want to tell them how to make their decisions.
To our Representative Nolan, I guess my response to that would be, well, when a county makes a decision and they won't include a house because part of the house isn't within the template on a standard that's more difficult than state law, at that point, at least in my mind, it gets to be a little silly, and so we would agree that, and for the most part, local control is the appropriate answer. But on the other hand, this is, at least this in our mind, is an example of a county that's going beyond what most people would consider to be common sense.
But in the case you say, the county could have just said it has to be six. And then you'd have, in order to change that ruling, you'd have to change their number.
Chair, Representative Nolan, the county could have said it was six, and if they would have said it was six, then our client wouldn't have spent the time and expense and application fees and hassle to go through a decision that she knew that she couldn't have qualified for. But again, when the line goes right through the dwelling, and the county's position is even if 99% of the dwelling is all over the line, if there's 1% that's not, the whole house comes out. At some point, that elevates form over substance and makes, at least in our mind, and hopefully in the mind of this body, somewhat of an irrational decision that maybe ought to be fixed.
One last follow-up. Is the county's regulation ambiguous?
General Representative Nolan, yes. The county's regulation is ambiguous because of the word within. Does within mean everything, the entire house, or does it mean a portion of the house? Now, LUBA deferred to the county's argument that within meant the entire
entire parcel, the entire dwelling had to be within the template. But to the extent, and because this was a rare circumstance, you know, you don't get very many applications where you draw your 160-acre square and it bisects right through a dwelling. So, yeah, we believe that the county's interpretation here was ambiguous, or their ordinance was ambiguous.
So it's really fair then to say that what you're trying to do is help people not present claims or request permits under ambiguous language. Is that what you're trying to do?
Judge, without Representative Nolan, in this case, we're simply trying to help a property owner who we believe has been denied a dwelling that at least the vast majority of the public would look at and say, well, this is kind of silly.
Thanks.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to testify on 3213? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3313. Seeing no further business before the committee, we shall adjourn the House Committee on Land Use.